Hey listeners, it's Jessica, and you're listening to another episode of Love Thy Neighbor. This is my 21st guest on my podcast episode today. Her name is Sabine, and I really think that you're going to really enjoy listening to her episode. I'm going to be taking a little bit of a break to spend time with family during this holiday season. But before we dive into this episode, I just wanted to sincerely thank you for, you know, showing up for this podcast, for listening, for dedicating your time. It really means a lot to me. And I'm just so humbled, you know, thinking about this holiday season, thinking about blessings that I've been given. I really think that this podcast, making this podcast, has really been one of the greatest blessings of this year. And honestly, I would say of my adult life, it's been a miraculous journey. I have met so many people that have changed my perceptions and have opened me up to being more tolerant and more understanding. And that's my goal. My goal is to create that kind of learning for you. And so I just wanted to say thank you, and I hope you look forward to this episode. Thank you.
Hey listeners, it's Jessica, and you're listening to another episode of Love Thy Neighbor. Tonight we're talking to Sabine Kelly, and I'm so very grateful that she wanted to come forward and share her experiences. So, hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I was wondering if you could just introduce yourself to the audience.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Sabine Kelly McKenzie. I'm married. I've been married for about a year and a half now. I live in Atlanta. I'm an only child, and I love everything youth and nonprofit.
What was it like growing up as a Black American woman in your neighborhood? And then when did you start seeing your racial identity as a minority in America?
Yeah, so I think growing up, I was born and raised in Miami. Growing up in Miami, I didn't really realize that there was a difference in being Black and being Hispanic and being white, Asian, or anything like that. I really didn't see a difference. I was in very diverse schools, and I did not see, or at least from my lens, I didn't see any type of segregation or racial issues or anything like that. It wasn't really until I went to college. I was raised in a Haitian family. My family speaks multiple languages. They are degreed. My father's a doctor. My mom has several master's degrees. And so when I went into college, I wanted to study political science. And that was the moment that I realized that I was a Black woman, because a white male in my political science class asked me, why was I there? And I simply told him, I'm here to get an education. I'm here in political science class. And he said, no, you're a Black woman. You should never be able to be in politics. And from there, it was horrible. From there, I finally realized, like, hey, I am Black. Like, I didn't realize that. I thought we were all one. And so I made it my point to show him why I was there. And so I finished that class as one of the top in that particular class. I had small moments when I was younger where, like, I wanted the white Barbie doll, or I wanted my hair to be long, like a white girl. I had great white friends. I loved them. My mom really had to instill into me that, you know, I was Black and, you know, my hair was beautiful. I'm beautiful. Even my white friends, their parents always gave me confidence. And so I think that's why I never really realized it until I went to college. And then in the workforce, it was horrible. I'm sure we'll get to that. Getting into the workforce, coming to Atlanta, really kind of made me realize, like, yeah, there's a difference, unfortunately, and some people are in your corner and some people aren't just because of your skin color.
When I think of Atlanta, I think of a city that's pretty diverse, something like New York or LA, but you still had experiences that were negative. Like, what were some of those experiences that you dealt with?
I think one thing, when I was in Miami, I was just there for school. So I was younger. I wasn't in the workforce yet. When I was in the workforce, I was doing interns and everything like that. So people were more prone to teach me and to help me out. But getting into the workforce in Atlanta, there was really a huge segregation. So most people that live in Atlanta know that there's a segregation from the north to the south side. So the north is predominantly white, and the south is predominantly Black. And so going into the workforce, I saw that there were much more white people in leadership. There were much more white people getting promotions than black people. And I'm not just talking about black women or black men, but I also saw a sexual or gender segregation as well. I saw more male-dominated leadership. I saw more male-dominated board groups and board teams. And so I found that there in the South, because we don't really consider South Florida the South, it's very metropolitan. It's very diverse. It's very, we feel like it's kind of a Caribbean of America. And so being in the true South in Atlanta, I really saw a segregation where people kind of looked at me. They may have looked down at me because I was a black woman, despite my education, despite my experience. I just may not get different promotions that someone else gets that's a different color of mine.
Do you think that there has been a greater effort in being more inclusive in these work environments?
Yeah, I definitely do think, I do notice a lot more companies are starting to get diverse and inclusive positions. So like teams that actually work on leading those agendas to make sure that companies and departments are more diverse and inclusive. I know a big one is Apple. They have a black in Apple, gay in Apple, women in Apple. So they're very diverse. A lot of nonprofits are also trying to get diverse. I know a lot of the nonprofits I work with and work for are becoming more diverse. But I think what the issue has become is now that it's almost something that has to be done rather than something that's invited, something that's to say, hey, we actually have black women. We actually have white women. We actually have people that are non-white males that are qualified and educated for these positions, rather than saying, oh, wait, we need to get somebody, maybe an Asian woman in this position to make us look diverse. And so it looks like it's being forced for some organizations and in some industries, rather than just letting it happen organically. I know for me, a lot of times, you know, I work in data. And so that kind of goes under the realm of technology. And technology is very hard to get women, black women, Asian women, Indian women, you know, Native American women, just all women of all colors to get into that field. And I feel like, again, I said that agenda is being pushed rather than just letting it happen because it's a good thing to do.
Yes. Do you think that one day it'll be more organic and that we kind of have to go through this learning period where people are, you know, making it seem like very forced? What do you think is going to end up happening?
Yeah, I think it's going to become organic. I think what's going to happen, so I know our generation really has come to a point where we want to make everyone's voice heard. So even if we feel like a certain group has been racist against us or has downed us or anything like that, we still want everyone's voice to be heard. And so I think our generation is really going to push it where it's just something that happens organically, that leadership teams are going to be diverse in age, diverse in race, diverse in gender, just all of that. I think that's another big thing is ageism. We just don't see these different things, and I'm hoping that it really does become organic. The more we talk about it, social media is huge with our generation, and the more we talk about it, it happens. A lot of people on social media are really getting out there about helping diverse groups in their workforce, in their industries, in their fields, and really preparing their resumes, helping them with experience, helping them with education, to be able to be in that playing field with everyone else. And so I think that's where that organic mindset is going to start to come in, is that the more we really work on it and the more we work on ourselves and our resume, the workforce will definitely become more diverse.
Yes, I totally agree with that. Sometimes it is frustrating, though, like right now, because it does seem like, oh, we need to fill this quota, you know, instead
right.
of being more understanding and more welcoming and genuine. Because I think the thing that's missing is often the genuine. We really want you because you're qualified.
I had an organization that was reaching out to me. I mean, they were really chasing after me to come be a consultant for them. And I had an interview and it slipped out. The person that was interviewing me said that they wanted me to help consult a Black nonprofit. And they kept on repeating this Black nonprofit. And so I finally realized that they really wanted to meet a quota. It wasn't that they wanted me for my experience, but they really just wanted to say, hey, we have a Black girl who is a consultant. And so that really made me step back to see, did I want to be that token person just to meet a quota, or did I really want to be at a institution, an organization, a company that really valued me? And I think that's going to be huge for our generation, is having organizations that really value us for who we are, just like you said, rather than just, hey, I need to meet this quota. So I'm going to hire this white girl to be on our board. I'm going to hire this African-American man to be, you know, a director here. And so really just valuing people and then opening up our eyes to, it's not just about color, but it's about experience and education and network.
Yes, that's so beautifully put. You mentioned, so you went to school in Miami for, was it your undergraduate degree?
Yes, yep.
And then where did you end up? So you ended up getting your MPA, and where did you get it? And then what was that experience like for you?
So undergrad, I got it at Florida International University. I got an undergrad in political science with a minor in education. Florida International University was a predominantly Hispanic institute, which I know a lot of people don't hear about, but it's the number one Hispanic serving institute. And so for graduate school, I wanted to do it a little different. I wanted to go to a historically Black college or university. So I chose to go to Clark Atlanta University in Clark, in Atlanta, Georgia. And I got an MPA in public policy and educational policy. So that was very, very different from my undergrad, because in undergrad, I was going through that program during the time that President Obama was doing his first campaign in political science, talking about that in a predominantly Hispanic-serving institute. And what I found was that his skin color almost became like an elephant in the room, that we didn't talk about the fact that he was actually a minority that was running for office. And going into a Black serving institute, it became such a badge of honor. Like, let's learn from what he did. Let's learn and realize that he made sure his entire slate was clean, because he knew that his stamp of being a minority kind of brought him down different levels than someone who wasn't. And so that was very interesting going through those two. It was very, very hard going through a Black serving institute. My professors wanted to make sure that I was the best of the best, which at times I thought was sad, because we have to be, a lot of times, minorities, period. And I continue to say, even white women, I know a lot of people don't think white women are minorities, but they are, because they're women. Minorities always have to make sure that we are 10 steps ahead of the white male, because we have to prove ourselves even more. And so that's what Clark really taught me, is that I had to prove myself much more than my white counterpart.
Yes, exactly. And back to that point on Obama, I think it is really interesting, because he really did have such a clean slate coming in, and he, mm-hmm. Worked really hard for the people. But I just find it was so interesting, because I think that there's still so much racism towards him when he was in office, and that people were extremely critical of things that he was doing that, other white men wouldn't have even gotten a flick of an eye for, And it's really interesting that you're right, that it seems like minorities really have to just go above and beyond in order to compensate and, be, quote, at the level that white men have been put at.
Absolutely. I think I think just a lot of people have a certain eye. They're looking at things from a certain lens, and they refuse to look at people for who they are rather than just their skin color, or rather than just their gender or what background they come from. And I think America would do so much better if we stopped looking at people with a stereotypical lens. If we just look at people for who they are, I think our country would strive so much more than where we are now.
Do you think that pointing out the diversity that people have is bad? Or is there a way to do it respectfully that another part of them?
I love that diversity. I love knowing that my friends come from different economical backgrounds, different educational backgrounds, different racial backgrounds. I love that. But I don't look at them from that lens. So I may not look at, you know, my white female friend as this person who, hey, she may be racist because she's white. Or I may not look at my friend who came from a less fortunate background and say, hey, she may ask me for money. I don't look at people like that. I look at them as a friend and their diversity, and whatever they went through in life can teach me more about loving everybody. I always say there is no equality because everyone is different, but there is equity. We can have everyone on the same playing field, knowing that everybody is different. And I think the difference is what makes America so, so beautiful. I love knowing that I can go into a restaurant and see different people in different walks of life. But I just hate that we treat people according to stereotypes, especially if we don't even know that person or if we don't even know about their culture.
Yes. I know that I've been guilty at least of, you know, maybe seeing somebody and making some snap judgment and then realizing that that was inappropriate and kind of trying to like rewire my brain and go, okay, don't think that, like, be better next time. Mm-hmm. It just feels like it's a constant uphill battle, but it's one that constantly needs to be fought, because if not, then you're just turning a blind eye to your racism or your prejudice or your biases, mm-hmm. whatever it is.
Absolutely. And I'll say I do it too. And I'm just like you, Jess. I have to catch myself and say, hey, you don't even know that person. So you don't know. You don't know the story. You don't know everything. So don't judge a book by its cover.
On your Instagram, you talk a lot about the benefits of financial freedom. I was wondering if you could talk about the benefits that you've had in your financial freedom.
Yeah. So my husband and I, before we got married, when we were dating, the first book that we read when we were dating was Dave Ramsey, Total Money Makeover. My husband was the one who actually said, hey, let's read this book. He didn't want to read about the five ways people should date or, you know, 10 top things Christian couples should do. He didn't want to read about that. He really wanted to start our relationship off with responsibility. And so I really appreciated that. I know a lot of people don't fully believe in Dave Ramsey's strategies on financial freedom, but I'm a huge person to say, eat the meat and spit out the bones. And so that's what we did. When we got married, we put all our bills together, we put all our debt together, and we really started to make a plan. We are not fully out of debt, but we were able to pay off all of our credit card debt. And that was an amazing hurdle for us. We did it in the first 9 months of our marriage. And that has freed up so much money to do other things. So where we splurge is traveling. We love to travel. So we're able to actually now pay for everything in cash with traveling. We're also paying down his car. We're paying off student loans. And it just feels so good to be able to do that. I know a lot of people hate paying bills, but we find such a blessing in paying bills, because that means we have money to pay for those bills, as well as we actually have a place to stay that requires bills. And so we, in our marriage, we find joy and happiness in creating a budget and seeing where our money is going in and going out. We find joy in seeing our savings really increase. And we encourage everybody around us. Several people have encouraged me in our financial journey. And if I start naming people, it would be way too many. But it's been mentors and pastors, best friends who have really shown us the freedom and financial, just being financially free. And so many times we're taught that, you know, you'll always have debt, but that's a choice. And America is, we're just drowning in debt. Everybody feels like it's okay to have debt, but knowing that I won't get a bill from a credit card company, or I won't have somebody knocking at the door saying I owe something and I have to go to court. Those type of things are such a relief that I don't think a lot of people really know how that feels. And so I always encourage people, if they can, at least put something in your savings every time you get paid, or try to pay down a debt or something. But it's been amazing. And we've just been able to really just have exciting moments. We've had downing moments, but we really celebrate every single win that we have with our financial freedom. I mean, even at the end of the year, I know we laugh and joke about, you know, looking at health insurance, but that is a blessing that we're able to say, I have health insurance. Granted, I would love to be in Canada where health insurance is free, but we have those blessings, and I think we really do have to count them, and we don't count them enough that we're able to pay bills, that even though it's cold outside, I'm able to have heat because I paid for whatever bill that supplies the heat. I have my Christmas tree up with lights because I'm able to pay the light bill. And so those type of blessings, we kind of look at it as, yeah, it's just a bill. But at the end of the day, you're able to eat and have fun and watch TV and go out on a date and drive wherever you want to drive. So it is a blessing, being able to have finances to pay those bills.
Exactly. You mentioned to me that you have been doing a lot of service. You've been doing a lot of service with the Boys and Girls Club and also Girls Who Code, which, for those that don't know, I actually also led a chartered group of Girls Who Code, so it's very dear and near to my heart. So I was just wondering if you could talk about some of the awesome experiences that you've had serving youth in those groups.
Yeah, so my biggest passion is youth. I'm also a youth pastor. So I love everything kids. I love being able to really help kids grow into the adult that they want to be, not who they're told to be, and really helping them develop into just awesome citizens. And so I work full-time at Boys and Girls Club. I work in our data department. So really surveying the kids, understanding what is important to them, understanding, are they having a good time at their clubs? What do they want to see changed? What are the staff talking about? So I really do a lot of the data, analyzing the data, and consulting the clubs on how they can be better and how they can improve their organizations. But just like you, Jess, Girls Who Code holds a dear, dear place in my heart. So I work with Girls Who Code part-time, and I help the facilitators who start the clubs. So that is so exciting that you're one of our facilitators. So I really help them with different ideas on how to do their clubs, how can they recruit more girls, and everything like that. I actually just came back from a conference where we were invited by Apple to learn more about coding and how to get kids, how to put technology into kids' hands so that they can guide their own education. And so I really love working with Girls Who Code, not only because, of course, I'm a girl, but also because I work in data. So I work with a lot of technology, and being able to really help and support the organization is amazing. It is an amazing organization. I will say Girls Who Code is like 10 steps ahead of a lot of companies on diversity. They are an amazing company to work with and to volunteer with.
Yeah, and at least in my experience when I was a facilitator, I guess that was my title, it was really empowering to see us hand out the laptops to the girls for the first time and kind of see the hesitation in their eyes, at least where I was teaching. Like, there was some hesitation, but then once they started getting into it, their eyes lit up and they were just so passionate about it. And I think it's because girls, at least, were kind of taught that, oh yeah, like the tech jobs go to the guys, and you know, the guys are tech savvy, and so it kind of makes us a little insecure sometimes. So I think it's really powerful to have groups like Girls Who Code. And I also did a mm-hmm. code camp also that helped predominantly girls of color to learn Scratch coating, and that was also a huge benefit. Like scratch coatings, I can't say enough about how amazing scratch coating is, just because it's so simple and just fun and not threatening, and I would recommend it to anybody.
Absolutely, it's amazing, and it is empowering to see the girls light up. It's empowering to go to seminars where the girls are actually coding, and even babies, they're even starting babies out with coding. But just to know that I am helping close the gender gap in technology and STEM programs and industries is amazing, and it's so much fun. It really is.
What is your biggest hope for the national Black American community? Because sometimes it can seem like just how the news portrays the Black community and how social media can sometimes portray the Black community, it can be negative. But at least for me in the past 5 years, I've kind of just seen this, like, this growth of amazing power and ability. And it's been so amazing to see that through film or, like what you said, like tech jobs, through all different types of jobs. And so what is one of your biggest hopes for the Black American community?
So I definitely think starting out, the Black community, we've really endured a lot of pain. And what I love about us is that we know how to still laugh and have fun. So I think one big thing that I want is for us to just remain and continue to grow our unity, continue to love on each other through hard times, whether it's through police brutality or you know, racial injustices or just segregation in the workforce or wherever it may be in our communities, even through gentrification. I just want us to come in as one and really unite and really invite other cultures that we trust, other people we trust, allies, to help us fight and combat that racism as one. I think we really love, we love hard. And so when we're hurt, it really hurts for the Black community because we're a village, but I want that village to remain. I know, you know, we're talking about toxic families and all of that, but I just want us to rebuild a healthy village. Another thing I wanted to do is have more conversations. And when I say conversations, I mean that very broadly. So have conversations about mental health. There's a stigma in the Black community that mental health means that you're crazy. So have those conversations. Have conversations about youth development. So if your child has ADHD or if your child has autism, does not mean they're dumb. Get them help. It just, to me, I always call it a different personality. I work with children who have autism and ADHD and ADD. So let's talk about those things. Let's talk about toxic families and sexual abuse and how people can heal from these things. Grandmama may have been a toxic family member, and how do we combat that with love and bring us in as a village so that we're able to show others love so that we aren't seen as an angry community anymore. We can really start turning that around and start loving everybody and really just being this strong community that our ancestors built us on. And I think the last thing I would say, Jess, is definitely for us to keep our culture. And I would say that for every community in America, for us to really keep our culture, our kids need to learn our native languages. Our kids need to learn our recipes that we cook with. Our kids need to see the attire that we dress in. I know for me, when I have kids, I'm going to teach them about Haitian culture, and I'm going to teach them about Creole, and my husband's going to teach them about the Southern dialect and Southern recipes and cuisine. And so I think definitely keeping our culture rich and true so that it can be passed down from generation to generation.
So what advice would you give to Black Americans that don't necessarily know where their roots are from? I mean, they might have an idea. They might take a DNA test, but to be honest, sometimes the DNA tests are even a little iffy there. What would you do to inspire them to continue to build their traditions and to maintain their communities?
Yeah, so I say if your family doesn't know as well, that I would say that's the first thing is to ask your family. But if they don't know, I think create traditions. Create things in your family that, hey, I'm going to pass down this ring from generation to generation, and it has some symbolic importance to it. start creating traditions. Traditions don't have to start from the 1800s and now it's passed down. I started a tradition. When I got married, I wore the dress that my grandmother made for my mom. It was the last dress she made before she passed away. And so my hopes is that my daughter will wear them or will create her christening gown from that dress or from some pieces of that fabric. And that's a tradition that we're hoping to start passing down to generations coming. So create traditions, whether it's around Christmas that, hey, every Christmas we're going to create this cornbread casserole or this cornbread dish that now it has become a family tradition so that everybody gets excited when it's a certain time or this special season or this special event that we know that this certain tradition is going to happen. Or even if it's a salute to everyone, a salutation, that every time I see everybody.
What advice would you give to a white person to inspire them to love their neighbors of color better?
I definitely would say one is that we are regular human beings. So I know a lot of times I make a strange look from, you know, someone that's white. So I definitely think saying hi, starting up a conversation is something so easy at Starbucks, at Panera Bread. Just the same way you would start a conversation with anyone else, I think is a great way. And once you create those friendships, really understanding, really learning about the Black community. So asking that person, hey, can I come to your family reunion? I want to learn more about your culture. I want to learn more about how you all, you know, cook. Like, I love your cooking. Show me a recipe. Teach me how to cook. Teach me how to dance. Those type of things rather than some of the insults that I may have heard, like, you know, do you wash your hair every day or things like that, that a lot of people may not see as an insult, but for us it can be. I think really wanting to learn, like, how, hey, can you teach me how, rather than is this something that you all do? I think it's better. And that goes for everybody, even for the Black community, rather than asking, you know, someone in the white community, do you all do this? We should always ask, can you teach me how to? And I think that opens up the conversation for us to be fluid about our culture, about how we do things, and about who we are. And inviting people into your culture as well, that we are in this world together. So let's see how we can coexist. I think just the last thing I would say is that definitely inviting that person to really show you how they need your help. So a lot of times with my friends, if they've had a loss in their family or another bad issue may have happened, I always ask, how can I help you? How can I support you? So I think one great question for the white community to ask the Black community is to say, hey, how can I help you? I know there was this police brutality. How can I be an ally for your community? Hey, I know, you know, Christmas is coming up and Christmas is huge for your family. What do you need me to do? Or how can I help, or whatever. So I think those questions can be phrased a little better so that we can start learning about each other. And then from there, we can love each other more and love each other greater.
That is a wrap on our episode. Thank you for listening. And feel free to leave some comments, some feedback, some stars, whatever you're feeling. I will see you in a few weeks. Have a great holiday season.